after the meeting for a few minutes to figure out?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and call this meeting of the Rental Services Commission to order. Sure. It's about 2:44 on March 20th. First, we'll go through roll call. Andreas, do you lead us through that one, wonderful one?
I can do it.
I'm not going to remember everyone's name right off the top of my head, especially since half the room is empty.
So, Alan Hines. Christian Bryan.
Here.
Christina Dirks.
Here.
Deborah Emissey. Ian Davey. Katrina Holland. Laura Golino de Lovato. Margo Black.
Here.
Mike Nuss.
Here.
Raul Preciado Mendez.
Here.
And Yoni Khan Yoknovitz.
Here. Thank you.
And Yoni, did you still want a quick announcement?
Just briefly, the Rules Subcommittee is going to organize our first meeting, I just was hoping that those members of the Rules Subcommittee who are here, I think I've talked to you all, just stay a few minutes after 5 o'clock so we can figure out meeting time and get the ball rolling. Thank you very much. I'm sorry that it has to be extra.
Thank you. And Andreas, staff update, sir.
It's all right.
So we have a few updates. We had our listening session last week on the 15th, I believe. It was well attended. We had around 30 people sign up to testify, and we did the full amount of testimony until 8 o'clock when we had to end. I think it's a valuable opportunity for the commission to hear from the community, as well as for the community to feel like they had a voice in participating. I know a number of people came up to us afterwards and were appreciative of us going out to Jericho and to meet somewhere other than downtown at a time other than during work hours. I know there have been questions about the makeup of the commission. We have one of our two soon-to-be new members joining us, Jessica Greenlee, who is also part of the Relocation Assistance Technical Advisory Group and works with Affinity. So thank you for joining us today. Hopefully we're shooting for a council date of April 11th, and so they should, both Jessica and Leah will hopefully be official members as of the next meeting, bringing us back up to 13 members. I wanted to remind everyone, I know it can be challenging, but I think it is helpful to stay responsive of your city email. I know it's an additional email for everyone to check. Christian has asked us to start doing RSVPs for the meeting, so that will be another email correspondence for you all to remember. I know there was also some confusion about this from the public records meeting, but you are allowed to have your email on your phone without your phone being public record, as long as you use the email for all your correspondences. It is what I do with my city email, and it is my recommendation because it is difficult for me to stay on top of my email when I have to get to a computer.
Yes. Is there a concern of forwarding the RSC email to another email?
So it is not an issue to receive messages because it's typically also going to a city email or from a city email. But if you start replying from your personal email, that is when it becomes a problem.
Okay.
We have an update. Yoni mentioned that he is going to work with the Rules Committee to set up a meeting time, but we also have a membership update. Deborah Imsey, who was on the committee, will be co-chairing the group with Yoni. And Mike Nuss has agreed to join the group as well, bringing it to 5 members. And those are all the updates I have.
Thank you. All right, so let's go right into, you guys going to do, give us kind of an overview of the interim administrative rules first?
Yes.
And then public testimony, then we discuss. Is that the plan?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
And so feel free, commission members, to ask questions as we go, but remember that there will be time to actually discuss the content after public testimony. So first, a quick overview of the policy itself. This is on the projector and not in your packets. It is pulled largely from the council presentation, so it is not new material. There were some changes that were made from the temporary relocation assistance policy to the permanent policy. Council clarified payment and notification timelines a little bit. They required landlords to provide tenants information about their rights when they give notices, which had been something the technical group discussed, and that was put into code. And it created more clarity around the different notices. So here there are three notices listed: no cause notices, rent increases of more than 10% in 12 months, and non-renewal of lease or non-renewal of lease on similar terms. The Housing Bureau ended up breaking out the second two, or the last into two, so we usually refer to four different triggers.
Can I clarify something?
Yes.
Do I need to speak into the mic?
Sure. Should be doing it as well.
So, when you say non-renewal of lease, that does not mean when a lease is not annually recertified when it defaults to a month-to-month, or is that what that's referring to?
A lease can roll over from a yearly lease into a month lease without triggering the assistance, but once the month-to-month lease ends, then no lease has been renewed, and it would trigger relocation assistance.
Thank you.
It also added reporting requirements. There are a few that have to happen. There is a payment requirement where anyone who is paying relocation assistance has to fill out a form and file it with the Housing Bureau. I believe that isn't required until May 1st. There is a date in the future. However, we have begun to receive some. Additionally, the exemptions switched. There was a change in the exemptions. We went from having the single unit exemption to a number of specific exemptions, but also we switched from allowing exemptions outright and added a requirement that people had to apply to the Housing Bureau to have their exemption acknowledged. And so our interim rules that we've produced are largely the Housing Bureau's articulation of what that process is. So we're really focused on the process for someone to receive an acknowledgement of their exemption. And then it gave direction to the Housing Bureau to make administrative rules and to staff an information line, which we've been doing, as well as processing the exemptions that come in. I'm gonna also mention at this point the rules we have are interim rules, which means they are temporary. They will be in place until we have permanent administrative rules. The city outlines a process for that, and it's a timeline of at least 60 days, which meant that we couldn't carry out that process between council adopting relocation assistance and us needing to have rules in place. So we adopted rules immediately. And those are the rules we will continue to use until adopting permanent rules. We do not yet have a timeline on the permanent administrative rules. We have been focusing our attention on responding to phone and email and in-person inquiries, as well as processing the exemptions. But once we have, once we feel like we are adequately meeting those needs, we will be shifting to creating the permanent rules. That process will look like the Housing Bureau issuing draft permanent rules, which will open a public comment period of at least 60 days. Right now, our plan is to have two public hearings specifically on those administrative rules, which means we are not necessarily suggesting to come back to the Rental Services Commission, since there will be two full public hearings dedicated to talking only about the rules. And then at the end of that public period, we will take all the feedback we have gathered on the draft permanent rules and issue permanent rules. Very permanent. And as I kind of hinted at, we have been struggling with capacity. We have not received any additional staff allocation as part of the changes to relocation assistance. So we have been having the policy and data team, staff, the helpline, the email, deal with walk-ins. We've asked for 2 full-time employees who would be dedicated to field the public as well as processing the exemptions. The soonest that could possibly happen would be in the spring bump, and that would be a decision by council. So that is where that information is. And lastly, this is just a reminder of the 12 exemptions presented by City Council. So these are written into code. Christina pointed out that there was not a latest version of the ordinance that was sent out with materials, so I have included one as a printout, so it's the handout that is not part of your packet. It's the ordinance with the amendments in it, and I will email that out after the meeting as well. So with that, I'm going to go from PowerPoint to walking you through some of the materials you have, which are extensive. The first thing is reminding me that we still have to approve the minutes. So we'll come back to that.
Everyone have a chance to review those wonderful minutes? They're sitting in your packet now. Would somebody like to make a motion that we approve them?
Second.
I don't think we had a first yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you motioned. Sorry,
oh,
sorry,
yeah,
sorry.
I guess I can on this one. I'm sorry. I'm used
is
to
yours?
Words where I'm not able to.
No.
Okay.
I will make a motion. I'll make a motion.
Thank you, Christina. I'm sure Margot's
second
still stands. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved. Anything else that I need to remember to do?
That's all I remember.
Thank you, sir.
So the first handout of content for all of you is the interim rules. This is where I'm going to devote the bulk of our attention. The first 2 pages are legal language. So I'm going to start on the 3rd page. First section tells that the administrative rules are to clarify how a landlord can claim an exemption. The only definition we're using right now is a natural person. And this was a definition that we started using to create a legal distinction from legal or corporate persons. So this was a term we started to use to create a distinction from a property that is owned by a person by their name as opposed to by an estate or by an LLC or other legal or business entity. The 3rd section outlines how to be eligible for an exemption and what that process looks like. So the process the Housing Bureau has defined has 4 steps. First, for someone to receive an exemption, they have to meet one of the criteria. So those are the exemptions that are in the code as well as up on the thinking on what that is.
Screen.
On the screen. Yeah. So the first step is they must meet the criteria for one of these exemptions. The second is that they have to fill the required forms. Not every exemption has a required form, but most of them do, and we'll get to that in the section below. The 3rd is they have to receive an acknowledgement letter from the Housing Bureau. I believe you were provided with a copy of one of those, but they have already changed. So I will send a more updated draft via email as well. And then the last step is that the landlord has to make a copy of the acknowledgement letter they receive and provide that to their tenant before, and then it lists the 4 notices as we're describing them, an increase termination notice, declining to renew or replace a rental agreement, or declining to renew or replace it on substantially the same terms. And then the last component there in section 3 describes how each exemption is valid for one use. unless specified other words. That is more or less what that translates to, is saying that once you receive an acknowledgement letter, that letter is good through issuing one of these notices, unless the administrative rules give some other instructions. Do we have any questions on that?
So the responsibilities on the landlord to provide the acknowledgement letter, the city does not send a copy to both the tenant and the landlord, is that correct?
At this time, that is correct.
And also, Claire, it is something that they would have to renew their application or approval for it with every tenancy, correct?
In many exemptions, yes. So now we can go through the exemption table. The left column is the exemption. The middle column is whether or not they have to file a form for that exemption. And the last column are additional stipulations that we have put on the exemption. The first one, we tenancies are generally exempt from landlord-tenant law. They do not have to require, they do not have to fill out a form, and there are no stipulations on that exemption. The second is for situations where a landlord rents out rooms in the dwelling unit as defined by the city, which is a structure that they occupy. They also do not have to file a form. And instead of it being per notice, this goes to your question, Christian, it does not expire each time they give a notice, but rather expires when they cease to use that dwelling unit as their personal or their principal residence. If you flip the page to page 4, we're on exemption 3. A tenant who occupies one unit of a duplex while the landlord's principal residence is the second unit in the duplex. They do have to file a form with the city, and this also stands as long as the landlord occupies the second unit. So again, it doesn't expire each time you give notice. The second bullet point is important. It is added to a number of the exemptions, I think 3, 4, and 5. It says that for new rental agreements beginning on March 8th, the landlord must provide the acknowledgement letter to the tenant before renting the dwelling unit. And so this means for new leases, a landlord would have to apply, receive their acknowledgement letter, and provide it before beginning to rent the unit in order to use that exemption. With number 4, an ADU, specifically one ADU, this has been clarified, as long as the owner lives on site, they do file a form. It is also valid as long as the owner is living on site, and it also requires a letter to be given at the beginning of new leases started after March 8th. Exemption 5, this is a landlord sabbatical of no more than 3 years. They do have to file a form, and there are a number of stipulations, thank you, for this requirement. So first is this exemption can only be used once a year. Next is, and this will repeat in a couple of them, once a landlord uses the exemption, they have to move in within 60 days of the tenant moving out. At that point, that unit must become the landlord's principal residence. It only applies to no-cause notices, and again, the provision that for new leases, an acknowledgement letter has to be given to the tenant before they rent the unit.
Quick question. on that line, the ones prior that mention that if for rental agreements beginning after March 8th, if they're already in a rental agreement currently, this changed. Was there a time limit set on how long landlords have to apply for these? Because the lease started prior to, so obviously they can't give it to them prior mm-hmm. to the lease. Has there been a time limit set, or what has it even been? Has that even come up?
The only time limit would be they obviously have 3 years from.
Well, let's back up. Let's say it's one where the owner occupies one of the duplex mm-hmm. units. Let's call it that one. They're not moving back or anything like that. There, as of right now, there's no time limit set. Like, all landlords in that have 60 days to get that done or anything like that.
Seems like it would just follow the process laid out.
Correct. So we're not requiring let's say, anyone who's renting an ADU to apply by this date, or they're out of compliance or ineligible for the exemption, we're simply saying that they have to apply before and receive notice and give the notice to the tenant. Sorry. And receive acknowledgement and give acknowledgement to the tenant before issuing a notice.
Gotcha.
So there isn't an expiration date per se, there's just a timeline for when they would have to do it, or more importantly, the order they'd have to use it.
Makes sense.
Okay. Exemption 6 is when the landlord rents their units while on military service. They would fill out the form. They would also have to move in within 60 days of the tenant moving out and begin using it as their principal residence, and it is also restricted to no-cause evictions. If we flip over to page 5, exemption 7, this is for immediate family member move-in. They do have to fill out the form. They can only use this exemption once a year. They cannot rent the unit to anyone except the immediate family member for a year. This is also where we use the natural person provision. A landlord has to be a natural person to use the exemption. This excludes properties that are owned by LLCs or other entities. The immediate family member has to move in within 60 days, and then it has to become their principal residence. It applies only for no-cause notices, and there is an additional check where a landlord cannot have an ownership interest in more than 4 units.
Do you guys identify immediate family? Do you define that concept?
We do not income check.
Do you define who is an immediate family member?
Yes, that is an excellent question. If you all go to the form, pick either of the verbs. I've been presenting this information a few times and have still not found the best way of presenting it because of the need to pay attention to multiple forms at the same time. So on the application form, if you go to question 5, it asks questions specific to each of the exemptions. And so then if you turn to exemption number 7, you can see what the actual user interface is for a landlord who's filling this out. So they would have to identify one of the options given. Immediate family member has been defined to include parent, grandparent, child, sibling, spouse, uncle, aunt, niece, nephew, and legal variations of those. And so we ask them to select which of the boxes this immediate family member is, to enter their name, certify, and this is how we're enforcing this at this time, self-certifying that they will not rent it to anyone else for a year, and that they don't own more than 4 units. On exemption 8, affordable housing, we do not require a landlord to submit a form. There's been direction given by council to work with the Community Alliance of Tenants and Home Forward and other affordable housing providers to see if there is a change that is needed to this. That process is being carried out right now. Number 9 is a dwelling unit subject to federal uniform relocation assistance. They are also not required to fill out a form. Exemption 10 is for a unit rendered uninhabitable by no action or inaction of a tenant or landlord. We are not requiring a form for this exemption at this time, but have provided guidance on our understanding of the intent of this, which is the unit's immediately uninhabitable and events that include but are not limited to natural disasters, as well as man-made disasters such as natural gas explosions.
Can I ask a question about that?
Of course.
So my concern with the way this language showed up in the code, should I be in the mic? My concern with the way this language showed up in the code, and correct Christina, please correct me if I'm wrong, but like any code violation, any housing code violation is technically uninhabitable. And while I see the intent of the ordinance in the third column, if there isn't a form required, it just seems like this is potentially ripe for, you know, abuse and misinterpretation. Because, you know, it says including but not limited to, so, you know. And so I just feel like more, you know, we need a form for this, and they need to describe the, even if we have to suspend the receive and ignore, if it's immediately uninhabitable. If it's immediately uninhabitable, they're not getting 90-day notice anyway, right? I mean,
correct.
So I guess I'm just back to wondering why we even need this exemption at all. But that being said, I feel like we should, because the immediately uninhabitable, I don't know. If a tenant were to get a no cause based on this exemption, doesn't require a form, and were to sue and say, you know, I think I deserve RELO, would this guidance be what a judge would consider in terms of, you know, choosing whether they deserve RELO or not, or
they'd
would the
look
city
at,
code?
Oh, sorry to interrupt. They'd probably look at, my guess is, the standard for habitability and whether the apartment itself has been deemed uninhabitable according to kind of case law.
I guess that's my concern, is that, and Christina, maybe you can chime in, my understanding is that uninhabitable according to case law is any code violation, you know, broken toilet.
Yeah, I mean, I think this exemption is really problematic. I mean, who's deeming it uninhabitable or not defined? If I don't think it's actually, is it a capitalized term? So, I mean, is it subject to the Landlord-Tenant Act definition of uninhabitable? Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. Mm-hmm.
To be transparent, this is one we spent a lot of time discussing. We had short notice between council considering adopting the measure on emergency and issuing interim rules, but for the weeks and months preceding, we're working on what we knew of the exemptions and creating a framework that we could implement. Around this exemption, the conversation centered on how the timeline would be different, especially because it is immediately uninhabitable, and also recognizing the lack of an obvious definition of what that would mean. And a decision was made to, given the lack of time and capacity, have it be something that the Housing Bureau didn't define or regulate at this time, because we hadn't felt like we had arrived on the perfect way of implementing it.
Margo, is your, just to spell it out, your concern is that a landlord would go through whatever process to certify, get a property certified as uninhabitable, whether it's through a judge or whether maybe just not fixing repairs so as to make it uninhabitable, so that at that juncture they wouldn't have to pay RELO?
I mean, my concern is that there's no form required for this, and that any violation of Title 29 housing code or whatever's in the state is defined to be uninhabitable. So, you know, that, that, like I said, a toilet can be broken.
Yeah.
And you can, a landlord, you know, I call and I'm like, hey, my toilet's broken. The landlord's like, awesome, let me give you the no cause eviction notice. And they don't have to fill out a form to say, toilet broken, right? And so it's possible for it to be abused in that way. Because in terms of going through the process, get it certified as uninhabitable, there is no process to have it certified.
Okay.
Different than being condemned.
Okay.
Right?
Well, and I, so part of it is also during the Relocation Advisory Committee, when we were talking about this language, we had specifically talked about acts of God, and that deeming the unit, making the unit uninhabitable, and this is obviously encompasses a whole lot more of instances where a landlord may be trying to argue they don't have to pay relocation assistance.
Right. And so if we don't even have a form, we can't even track potential abuses.
Right.
I know one of the decisions in moving from Act of God and natural disaster language to the language that is present was a desire to include man-made disasters, specifically natural gas explosion has been mentioned multiple times. And so I know that that was part of the intent of it.
I was just going to add in Title 29, a broken toilet does not deem a unit uninhabitable. It's if it's a life safety violation, and if the unit is occupied at time of life safety violation, it is still habitable. It's once that unit goes vacant, then it cannot become habitable during that an open life safety violation. So I don't think it's as bad as you think it is.
Yeah, I'm not.
In the examples that you mentioned, that would be clearly an inaction or an action that created that instance. A broken toilet, an inaction to fix it. So, I don't think it's as open-ended as you think it is.
And I think this is one we, I anticipate we will continue to talk about a great deal. Moving on to exemption number 11, a dwelling unit rented for less than 6 months with a demolition permit. Things to note is the exemption was written to have verification of submission of the demolition permit. We've been notified that demolition permits take a while to be processed, so we're not asking for a permit to be approved, simply for that application to have been submitted. They would be filling out a form for this one. And then the last exemption, exemption number 12, this is where a landlord has given a fixed term lease, notified the tenant before beginning occupancy. That is a key term that has come up so far. It is occupancy, not a rental agreement per se. So a new rental agreement does not restart the clock on this one. It has to be, notice has to be given before the tenant occupies the unit, and that the landlord is intending to sell it or permanently convert it to a use that is not included in the Relocation Act. So on this one, we have stipulated that it has to, whatever occurs has to occur within 60 days of the tenant moving out, and it is only valid for no cause evictions.
When you say it's any of these exemptions are only valid for no cause evictions, that means the non-renewal of a lease
right.
does not, what does that mean?
It is, we are treating it the same as a no cause eviction. The challenge that we entered is while the Housing Bureau has broken out the triggers into four categories, the ordinance breaks it out into three categories where non-renewal of lease is the same as not renewing the lease on substantially the same terms. And so at the Housing Bureau, our intent is for the things that apply to no cause evictions apply to anything that is a permanent end to a lease, but do not apply to a different lease. And so we avoided using language of non-renewal of lease out of concern it could create ambiguity that would include leases that were issued with different terms as part of what is exempted. And so we are interpreting this to include terminations of leases.
Can I just flag? I think there will be an issue moving forward with the fact that the interim rules say this only applies to no cause. This doesn't apply to rent increases when the language of the ordinance doesn't speak to that. And I'm sure you guys have flagged that.
Community Alliance of Tenants is like that as well.
I have just a couple things. So have we defined anywhere what principal residence means?
It is a term that is used repeatedly throughout the ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's used for a number of the exemptions in their actual exemption text in code. It is not capitalized, so there's not a legal definition in code. We're relying on existing definitions that already are used in the housing market around people having a primary residence as opposed as something that is distinct from secondary or investment properties. In the form itself, if you flip to the sections where, and I think this will be helpful, I don't want to take all of your time by presenting, but I think one of the more useful parts to look at in the forms is Section 5, where we go exemption by exemption and say what we're asking for those. So what we're doing for, 3, 4, 5, and anything else that has some mention or intent of principal residence is we're asking for them to submit documentation, and we're using the documentation as our proof of principal residence. And right now we're using, some of them are time restricted, some aren't. We're asking for something from a government agency, electric or gas utility, financial institution, employer, or insurance company that connects the name of the person applying to the dwelling unit that is being applied for an exemption. We have already flagged that from the applications that have come in, utility has not been a good connection of the applicant to that being their principal residence. We had 20 applications come in, and in some of those, it's come up with the sabbatical, the landlord gone for less than 3 years, they presented utility bills from the period they weren't inhabiting the unit, which tells us that the utility bill is not proving that they live at the unit.
Oh, because they probably paid the utilities as part of the rental while they were gone or something.
Which is uncommon in multi-family, but very common in single family. And so this is a list that we will be actively revising, but it is how we are on our end trying to regulate what principal residence is.
Okay, and I think you mentioned it, some of the, I guess I have tiny concern, so I just marked it on the exemption 3, the ADU. It says this exemption stands as long as the landlord uses the exempted dwelling as their principal residence. Okay, so first, just what is principal residence? But then for what time period? Because I've seen, with these types of rules, you can imagine a landlord say, well, you just move in for a day. Now it's your principal residence while you apply, and then you can move out as soon as you get your exemption form or whatever. So is there anything that when we are sort of requiring principal residency that it is for some time period? I saw on the immediate family member one that they have to, we can't re-rent it for a year, but for the purpose of these other exemptions where we're demonstrating principal residency, is there some, 3 months prior to the application date for at least 3 months after or something like that?
We have not required that at this time. For transparency, when we issued the final version of these rules and these forms, it was with a mind to create a manageable process. And so there are additional steps that were discussed that we did not choose to put in the interim rules because we did not have the capacity to staff that. Mm-hmm. And it is possible that we could add requirements like that in draft rules.
That's all you have for that overview? To be continued on our discussion section of the agenda. So do we have a public testimony list? No one for public testimony. This is going to be a quick meeting. All right. Fair enough. So we'll go right back to the same topic and discuss it. So give me an idea. I mean, I know, so it's going to be on, of course, City Council to, finalize and approve the final rules. I assume the main goal from us is just to basically get our opinion on, here's the areas we would like looked at, here is what we would, changes we would recommend seeing. So I'll open it up at this point for discussion. I hesitate because we've got, barely half of our committee here, and we're going to have even two brand new committee members, most likely, crossing our fingers, by the next commission meeting. So it might also be something where I'm open. I know Ian was hoping we were able to kind of tackle this, discuss it, put together some recommendations in one meeting. but something towards the end when we're wrapping up today, just kind of be thinking about this as we go along, if you guys are going to want to maybe have this, maybe take back to the executive committee a recommendation to try and keep this on the schedule for our next RSC meeting as well. So with that, I'll open it up. I know there's been a number of people that have probably have more questions and concerns. So anyone out there, anyone on the commission that wants to, and then also let's go ahead and use our name placards so we don't get twisted up. Andres?
So again, just to remind you of high level overview, the interim rules will not necessarily be, in fact, I'm pretty confident saying, the interim rules will not be the draft permanent rules, but they will inform the draft permanent rules that we create. And so the reason we're bringing the interim rules before you is because, one, we're directed to by council, but two, it is an opportunity for all of you to give your input that we can do our best to incorporate and consider when we create the draft permanent rules. And so it's an opportunity to shape those. At this time, our thought is to have the public process for the permanent rules carried out separate from the commission. If there's a desire, it can come back to the commission. But our mindset was that you are all absolutely more than welcome to be a vocal part of the public process. But we know that there's been a concern about getting through the topics the commission has to discuss. And so we didn't want to take multiple months of meeting to discuss the administrative rules. It's more than, you are all more than welcome to choose to do that, but that was our initial thought. And so we wanted to provide you the opportunity to discuss the bones of it, which will come from the interim rules, and to shape the draft rules, and then to engage vocally in the permanent rulemaking process.
What do you think, Christian?
I mean, I'm not breaking him. Because I mean, technically, she's a member of the public still, right? I can't imagine any one of us feel strongly about it. I mean, half of us in here served with her on the RELA Oversight Committee, so I think you would definitely add a good perspective. So, if it's up to me, I say go for it. All right,
I'll just go through the list of things I had flagged. And I think I want to say at the outset, I was really happy when I saw these interim rules. I thought you guys did a really good job in the amount of time you had to try to kind of address some of the potential abuses. So thank you for that. So on 3 and 4, Margot already kind of flagged this issue about the primary residence. I do think if we're thinking about the final rules, there should be some language around how long the landlord has to live there, because I could definitely see, you know, the duplex next door becomes vacant, the landlord moves in for a week or two while they give the notice and then moves back out. So I think those should have some additional qualifications. Similarly, for 5 and 6, where they talk about that the landlord needs to do something within 60 days of moving out, either move back into their residence, just move back into their residence for both of these, either sabbatical or military leave. Again, I think there maybe should be a requirement as to how long the landlord should have to live there before, in order to claim this exemption, similar to what you have with the family member exemption. For number 7, you talk about the family member living there for the year. I think that's really good to put a limit on it, or a minimum amount of time. I'm just not sure what it means for the year. Is that for the remainder of the calendar year or for 12 months?
Mm-hmm. We can clarify that, but it's intended to be 12 months.
Yeah, that's what I assume, but I think that language is a little wonky. We talked a little bit about number 10 on the uninhabitable. I think there's a lot of issues with that. I noticed on number 11 with the verification of the demo permit, in the form that the landlord submits, it requires notification, a self-certification. They notify the tenant prior to occupancy, but I didn't see that kind of fleshed out here on the exemption explanation. I don't know if that matters, but and so for both 11 and 12, which do at least in the form, for the landlord certification, require the landlord to certify that they gave notice. It'd be really nice if that notice had to be written notice as opposed to some kind of oral notice, because I could see that, you know, being abused and just being something that's briefly mentioned in the conversation about a hundred other things while a tenant is signing a rental agreement. And then for the exemptions that don't require an exemption form to be submitted to PHB, which I have as 1 through 2 and 8 through 10, I think one of the real benefits to tenants of this exemption form is the acknowledgement that has to go to the tenant. And so those tenants that are living in units that are falling under one of those exemptions that don't require the form aren't getting that notice of the exemption. So I think when we're talking about the final rules, even if it's a decision is made that the landlords don't need to submit the exemption form to PHB, there still should be some notification requirement to the tenant that they don't have, that the landlord is claiming an exemption of some form prior to doing one of those triggering acts.
What about week-to-week tenancies? Notice requirement, so they can stay somewhere a week.
Yeah, I mean, that may be fairly obvious and probably not necessary, but the rest I could see definitely would benefit from some notice. And then we already raised this a little bit, but, you know, what if the landlord doesn't comply? You know, they submit the verification form and then the family never moves in, or they don't list the home. And I'm not sure that's really something PHB is going to tackle, but I think it's something we need to kind of keep in the back of our heads, or what are we going to do with those situations? And then, I'm sorry, can I just go through my list, and then I may not talk for the rest of the meeting. On the application form, under number 7, I think it would be great, this is the family member exemption, if they want to move in an immediate family member, if the family member also had to submit a declaration. That would be, I think, even help protect further against potential abuses. And then on number 12, where the landlord is going to use the building for some other use, the language of the exemption also speaks to putting the house on the market. So I noticed in the question number 3, it talks about what other use will be put to. It may be useful to also talk about, you know, the date place was listed for sale, or some other way to verify that it's going to another use or being sold, because the questions here seem to just focus on an alternative use, not for the sale. Thanks.
Alex, take it. Go for
it. So my question kind of tacks on to what Christina was bringing up in terms of the notices being not sent out to folks who receive or have exemptions to their landlords that aren't required to submit the REA form. My question earlier, much earlier, so I don't expect you to remember, but regarding the Housing Bureau being the one who sends out the letters, and I know that you mentioned that several of the way that this ordinance was structured and many of the issues were laid out was with capacity issues in mind. I'm wondering if that would, if the Housing Bureau or the city were the one to actually issue those notices, if that could potentially also open up barriers to accessibility, like providing those notices in different languages and having stuff available to folks who might not necessarily understand them. And also just ensure compliance, right? Like have that kind of thing provided as a uniform. So I know that that's like probably a really easy thing to say and a big ask, likely in the amount of cases that would have to be sent out throughout the city. But just with that in mind, I think the resources available to have a standardized notice from the Housing Bureau saying, here is the thing that is the reason why you're getting this exemption, or your landlord filed for this, we're letting you know, right? Like I think that would be helpful. Especially for folks who don't necessarily have great relationships or communications with their landlords, right? Like they have language barriers or things get lost in translation. So just wanted to flag that.
Thank you. I think that's really helpful. I know, I think it should be something that we still discuss. I know the reason we decided not to do it on an interim basis was a concern with the cost. A point earlier in the process, we were considering doing a mailer to all residential addresses to notify them, and the cost was astronomical.
Sure.
And so not knowing how many exemptions we would get, we were nervous about committing to mailing everyone an exemption. But that is something we can definitely reevaluate in the future.
Thank you. And sorry, just to add, I know that might be like a council ask, like it's something that needs to be included in the budget, but I think that's something that needs to be laid out pretty clearly, that not only would that benefit tenants, but it would also potentially reduce some of the burden on landlords and having to communicate and know all that stuff, right? So, thanks.
Thank you. I do have one question on, well, I guess I have two. Number seven, you have, obviously, at the bottom, the exemption only applies to landlord with an ownership interest in four or less units. I'm assuming you picked four because that's kind of the known dividing line, whether you're talking insurance or lending or whatever, between residential and commercial properties. With that said, what was the thinking behind the essentially a landlord not being able to be use this exemption if their property, maybe it's just one single family home, happens to be owned by their LLC? Instead of, because, I mean, it feels like you don't need both. I mean, just leaving the four covers it. And there's lots of reasons beyond, you know, there's lots of reasons to have a property in an LLC versus your own personal name, if nothing else, just because you want to run it like a business. And technically, you know, you're pulling income from it, and it's how you should be setting it up. So maybe give us a little more insight on the thinking behind that one.
Yeah, I'm appreciating this because you're all touching on topics that we discussed at length. So this is another case where the Housing Bureau made a decision and we were trying to split the difference between a few different priorities. Our concern was properties that were owned by a entity that was comprised of multiple people, and so it was multiple people going in on a property and that ownership being divided in multiple ways, and so that being a complicated situation. We were comfortable with the idea of, we understand and respect the business sense of putting a property in an LLC, and our preference would have been for properties in an LLC that are owned by an individual or a couple, a family member in some way, to be able to use the exemption, but that would require us to be asking and taking in partnership information about LLCs and other entities and then preserving those as part of public record. And so that was a decision that was made by the director that was not a path we wanted to go down, and as a result the decision was made to make it only applicable to natural ownership or natural person ownership. But I think there definitely was a concern around people who are putting their property in an LLC because it is a financially responsible thing to do. And genuinely own that is their LLC, it is one person or two people or whatever it is, but being concerned about opening it up to the entire realm of ownership options, given that we're trying to make it focus on smaller ownership. And so any suggestions are always welcome.
I don't know that I am anywhere close to the right expert on this, so you know, don't have me be the last person that is asked. But I would imagine, I get where the intent is, because it definitely makes sense. I mean, if you had, you know, a 10-person LLC that owns a property, you know, whose brother is the one that makes you qualify? But I feel like, you know, I would imagine within the city attorneys and everything else, we employ some very intelligent people that should be able to separate that out so that if it is someone like a husband and wife or a single owner LLC or something like that, where that they would still qualify, assuming they have four or less units, you know. I would imagine, I don't know the legal wording by any stretch of the language, but I would imagine there's got to be a way to maybe flesh that out, so that's whether, you know, if I just happen to own one or two units and I'm moving back into one, you know, just the simple fact that I hold it in an LLC doesn't make it so I don't qualify, whereas if I just happen to fill out the paperwork differently, I would have qualified.
I'll definitely pass that on, but that reminded me of a secondary concern that was raised during the process, which is staff being able to appropriately interpret the documents that they're given and the proof that they're given. We do have a budget ask for two positions, but these are admin staff. I'm currently processing the exemptions and then becoming familiar with reading permits to understand what is and isn't an ADU. And there was a concern about extending that into ownership and asking staff to become fluent in all forms of property ownership and understanding those. But I will definitely pass this on.
I have a lot of confidence in our staff. Margo, I am intentionally skipping you for good reason. I think Jessica has a comment on this specific subject, sorry, and I think you're ready wanting to go over your list of things, correct?
I'll be brief about it, but there is a specific LLC type that could be beneficial. It's called an SPE, which is a single purpose entity, which is often owned by a single individual and is a pass-through entity, so they're issued a single K-1 to that person directly, which could help resolve some of that, though I am also concerned about the fact that estates are exempt, because often families will inherit a house that their parents own, end up renting it out, then have a sibling or somebody in the family that ends up needing that additional housing support and would be the ideal situation that this exemption was drafted for. And that, I feel, really deserves a second look. So.
What's a K-1?
It's an accounting form that's issued when you have an LLC for you to file with your taxes.
Basically, it softens the tax blow if your LLC is really purely set up to pass income straight through to a sole proprietor versus
kind of cuts out one level of taxes. Just makes it, say, I need your last year's K-1, and that'll answer every question you need.
But that would not include estates.
That would not.
Right. And I know that was another thing that was flagged by our director, is a desire to recognize that they operate similarly.
Mm-hmm. And as an estate, you know, it's family members typically involved. So.
And I just had one other one that I wanted to flag, got flagged during the council meeting, but I noticed it didn't actually change. On number 10, the way that it is written, which I guess technically I'd be talking about in a for-cause eviction at that point, so maybe that's why it's a mute point and there's something else I'm missing, but the way that it's written, technically a tenant could damage the property to the point of it being uninhabitable and the landlord wouldn't qualify for the uninhabitability exemption of that. So I was just curious, I assume there's more discussion about that because I know there was at least one council member that brought that up as well.
I flagged that before or shortly after the first hearing internally for staff, and that is exactly the answer, that it would then be a for-cause situation. If a tenant is intentionally damaging the unit, then it is a for-cause.
You need to treat that pretty expedited. One at that point.
My
turn? Yep, by all means.
Okay, I don't have much. I think on the park, okay, so I think I'm echoing what Yoni or Roel said about, I think for the number two, occupying the same building as a landlord, or any of the ones where the forms aren't required, it would be good for the tenant to have some acknowledgement of that. I know that we get a lot of roommate situations who are living with the owner who aren't quite sure whether or not they qualify, and I just think knowing that before they move in ideally is good. And to that effect, on the number 12, the lease, or the fixed term lease, says, we say, a dwelling unit where the landlord has provided a fixed term tenancy and notified the tenant prior to occupancy of the landlord's intent to sell or permanently convert the dwelling unit. I would like to make sure, first of all, when they fill out their REA, it would be great if we ask them for a copy of the notice that they gave to the tenant informing them of that, which goes along with Christina saying that it should be written notice, you know, not a verbal or a text. And I don't know if this actually requires code change or we can put it in our rules, but it would be really great if that notice makes it really clear that the tenant knows that they won't get relocation, because I mean one of the things that comes up a lot with leases is, well, you know, of course there's no expectation that it would be renewed. It's a one-year lease and it ends, when really often they are renewed because it's long-term housing. So the fact that it just says that it has an end date and doesn't include the automatically rolls over to month-to-month language, which you know, no one knows to look for, may to the landlord sound like they gave that tenant notice. That's the lease ends. And so to make that really explicit to the tenant moving in, I know I'm moving out on this day and I know that I'm not getting relocated because this is all above board, would be good. So if that language could just include, you know, knows of a landlord's intent to sell or permanently convert and informs the tenant that they will not qualify for relocation, would be good. And I guess, I think Christina asked about this, but if the landlord in theory needs to, well, they don't need to apply, they don't need to fill out the REA before that tenancy begins, right? So, but in theory, they need to notify the tenant before the tenancy begins, you know, at least post March 8th anyway. And then they don't sell or their plans change. Is the tenant still exempt or is the landlord still exempt?
Our intent is that they would not be exempt.
Okay, because there isn't like a can only apply once or, I don't know, I guess it just feels like there's still some squishiness there that could be tightened up. And then on the form that they do fill out, okay, well, first of all, I really would love, I think I just said it, but I'd really love the roommates, the number twos, to fill out a form, even if it's a much less arduous process just for data collection processes or purposes, because we do know so many more people are house sharing in Portland because it's the only way that they can afford to live anywhere. And so it'd just be good to start to know, you know, what that population looks like. But then on the form, when landlords do have to fill this out, it would be really great to get demographic info of the tenants, even if it's pretty sparse, like, you know, school-age children, you know, senior citizens, you know, any minority categories that we know about, even if it's just there's a box for unknown, because they may not know. But it would be great to, as we evaluate who RELO is impacting and not, if we have information on kids and minorities and seniors and people with disabilities, to the best of our ability, that would be great.
A couple things on that. I believe, like for instance, talking about, you know, if you notify the tenant ahead of time and then your plans change and everything, I believe with the intent of the change in use or the sale happening within 60 days of the tenant moving out, I believe kind of covers that, because if you changed your mind and then tried to still get out for the exact same exemption but then didn't actually convert it or try to sell it, then you would be in violation. At least that's the way that I've interpreted it. Just word of caution on the collecting of demographics. I would love for that to be something that is in a questionnaire that the city sends my tenants. Quite frankly, I don't ever want to ask any of my tenants what their nationality is, or that doesn't find its way onto my applications or anything like that, because quite honestly, any landlord would be kind of scared to actually ask for that information at really any time in the tenancy. So, but that I would be all for the city sending that out as a follow-up after the confirmation of an exemption or whatever it may be.
Right, so if maybe in the acknowledgement form that the landlord has to provide, and it would be great if PHB also provided that or provided, and I mean, I hear the arguments for why that may not be possible, but maybe that form can alert tenants to the ability to like fill out a survey with their demographic information, you know, call or an online survey or something like that, just so that there's an opportunity to connect those two dots if we can't ask the landlord for it.
What's more effective on the exemption forms or on the actual?
Use your mic.
What would be a more effective data source would be to have that on the actual payment form or the exemption form?
That's an interesting thing.
It seems, I mean, I can see it going both ways. On the payment form, you're seeing who's actually receiving RELO on an exemption and how that affects different classes. On the exemption form, you can see how the exemptions themselves are affecting. So I can see it'd be valuable on both.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But definitely not have the landlord fill that part out.
Yeah. Just one real quick, just kind of point of order. If you're not talking, make sure your mic is turned off, because it cuts the volume by half. I think, Jessica, you were next.
I got my card up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
Go for it.
I just kind of wanted to, apart from the exemptions, go through kind of this, the burden shifting process for RELO. So it starts off, I guess, with a no-cause eviction. Just taking it from start to end, starts with a no-cause eviction, let's say, being issued, correct? Whose obligation is it at that point to inform whoever is living there that they may be entitled to RELO? Landlord.
So something I did not provide is on the, I can navigate to it in a second. On the website, we have a how it works graphic that walks through these, and it didn't walk through how the ordinance works, but in a situation where a no cause is issued, it is on the landlord to comply with the process.
Okay. So the landlord complies, and the tenant doesn't have to ask, the landlord is required to comply.
With
a no cause. Okay. So let's say that the unit is not exempt and the landlord pays at that point. When does money transfer hands? 45 days before the notice expires. So you have 90 days notice, but you have to receive payment within 45 days. What happens if the person occupying the apartment accepts the money? Is there some sort of certification that the money's been exchanged? Okay. Is there some sort of documentation that one party can establish that the money's exchanged?
I think in many situations, landlords are finding their own process to make sure that they have proof.
What happens now that once money's been exchanged and the 90 days is up and no one left?
The tenant, the RELO tag walked through this, the tenant is obligated to pay, and I believe there might even be a period of time that they have to pay by.
So they have
for
to,
no
not
cost.
For no cost, it would just be an FTE.
Yeah,
it would. I would believe, I'm not exactly sure how the transfer payment would work, but it would change at that moment, basically the day after the last day of that no-cause notice. At that moment, the tenant is in violation and is actually being evicted for cause, which then would not trigger RELO. So I'm not quite sure exactly how the courts would flush that out.
Right.
Because if it turns into a for cause,
they would just file on their no-cause.
There, so... Right.
Right,
but you're filing on that turns it into a for-cause eviction.
No, it's still an eviction based on a no-cause notice.
Well, the definition of eviction is forced.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're all holdover tenants, regardless of the type of notice they gave you.
Which creates a for-cause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's illegal holdover, right?
Which makes it a for-cause.
Yeah.
But you're filing on the underlying no-cause notice. I mean, that's your basis. That's your the jurisdiction of the court.
The illegal holdover is because of
the no-cause notice.
Yeah.
That's what initiated it, but it's the being held over what changes it to a for-cause.
Maybe we're talking about semantics.
I think so.
Which is the basis of my question.
Right.
Is those semantics? I mean, how is that going to be viewed? Because, I mean, any... landlord views that as, yes, I asked them to move out, and then they violated that, which turns it into a for cause, which then makes them not eligible for this relocation, which means in addition to the now for cause eviction, you also owe me this amount of money on top of whatever else, if there is anything else. I mean, that the way that the evictions work and everything, and the way that it's written, that seems like a logical progression, but the reason I ask the question is because it's not necessarily specifically spelled out either. On what would happen with that money, and if that is something where the landlord gets their eviction, moves forward with it, and the tenant retains that, it's not accounted for in the move out, or since it turned into a for cause, that negates everything that had to do with the relocation, because it's now a for cause eviction and not a no cause anymore. So, something to flag and make sure is discussed amongst legal and how that's supposed to work.
So, in a hypothetical scenario where a tenant has not moved, and suppose they have no intention of moving. So I'm distinguishing between the tenant who maybe needs a few extra days or whatever, right? And the tenant who's like, go ahead and send the sheriff, I'm not going anywhere. If the landlord wanted the RELO back and felt entitled to it, you know, really regardless of the tenant. And then the FED process, you'd either negotiate that in first appearance, I understand collecting is a whole different story, or you go to trial and a judge at that point in time could say, you know, the tenant has to go and they owe you this money back.
No.
That would be a small thing.
Yeah. Eviction is only about possession. There's no monetary judgment.
Yeah, the only time you can talk, money is actually
agree. Okay. So it would be small claims and the judgment.
Right. Nobody's testing you.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a handout on the, I will remember this screen, that walks through some of the items or some of the considerations in how relocation assistance works. So we've tried to break it down into the different processes that happen, either a no cause, an increase, a change in lease terms, or a non-renewal. And it has there the timelines that are currently agreed on. So for a no cause, it's a landlord's action and they have to provide payment 45 days before termination of lease. For rent increase, it's tenant action. They have to provide notification to the landlord that they're requesting assistance within 45 days of the rent increase, and then the landlord is obligated to pay within 31 days of when the tenant provides written request. Change in lease terms, it's tenant action again. Once again, within 45 days of a substantial change in lease terms, the tenant has to request relocation assistance, and the landlord must pay within 31 days of receiving the tenant's written request. And the last one is non-renewal, which is back to a landlord action of having to pay within 45 days before the lease would be terminated. And then we included the amounts in the portion below. So hopefully it helps a little bit. It's on our website. I will show you how to get to it because I think it's helpful.
Can I just
have
a question?
Really quick. So. Because I think this is helpful for all of you to have, if you're not super familiar with it, on the Housing Bureau website, it will generally not look like this. And then, if you go to Rental Services, which will usually be a tab on the top, and click on it, it'll take you to our page on Rental Services. You are on here somewhere. There you are, right here. But before you is our portion on mandatory rental relocation assistance. You click on that, it takes you to the page for it. Here you have a description of what it is, what it applies to, the exemptions written out, the assistance amounts, and then we have subcategories and general information. Oops. In general information, you will have our administrative rules, which we went over. You can check Portland maps, see the ordinance, the handout, how it works, handout is here. This is where people can apply for an exemption online. This is where people can get a notice of payment form, and then there are additional resources as well. That is all.
Okay, in terms of the form that you have to fill out to show that you've paid relocation, first question, what if a landlord doesn't fill out that form after you've paid it?
There is no penalty in the ordinance.
Okay. And then, so I've been working with tenants in a building who got yet another trick notice that we talked about before that essentially tells the tenants to, you know, terminate their own tenancies or, you know, choose their rent increase. This is sort of unique in that they are offering to pay the tenants relocation when they terminate their own tenancies, but on a completely different timeline and protocol than, you know, what is laid out here, because it's not technically relocation. It's something the tenants are opting into. So A, I guess I'm wondering what the pathway is to get the ordinance fixed to require that any change of lease terms, you know, requires tenants to be given information about relocation and not just rent increases no cost notices, because this is, again, you know, not any of the type of notices that we are looking for It's just a friendly letter to the tenants that is very explicitly not any of those notices, and kind of skirting around everything. And two, wanting to know if, you know, when they do pay essentially the same as relocation, but on their own timelines and guidelines, would they be compelled to report it, or is this a way to kind of get around the reporting too, to not show that they're displacing hundreds of tenants from a building?
So at this time, the Housing Bureau has not been directed to revise the ordinance or the code language in any way. We can ask the mayor's office, as a request from a member of the RSC, what the process would be of changing the language and code. My understanding is that the only reason someone would report a payment is if they were following the ordinance and paying relocation assistance as required in the ordinance. So I would not anticipate that a alternate, not quite relocation assistance, but offer of payment from the landlord would also not be required to submit documentation as payment.
So when they, when the actual draft language is produced, is that something that you'll bring back to us as well?
I anticipate we will distribute draft permanent rules through our listservs, and that would definitely include our advisory bodies, so you would be notified whenever we had draft permanent language.
That's good, that's right.
I just wanted to revisit the request for the collection of demographic information and things like that. So the reporting of the payment at the location, that notice goes to the city. It's not necessarily provided to the tenant. Correct. So that wouldn't necessarily be helpful or useful in the collection of that. But my understanding was as well that the city did not prescribe the notification, how the notice needed to be provided to the tenant initially, so the only collection point where you could request that would be on the acknowledgement form provided by PHP. Is that a correct understanding of that? And I'm also a little, I just get very concerned about involuntary collection of data. It would definitely need to be something that the tenant would agree to, because asking the landlord to take on the liability is concerning.
I was just going to say, on this form, there's no real sensitive data. There's nothing about the tenant.
No, not here. I think there was just common background request that was made to add that as part of the process.
Which, I think, if we really think about it, my guess is probably everyone at the table would agree that a landlord shouldn't be collecting demographic data. I mean, personally, as a landlord, I don't want to, because I don't want there to be anything that says, I knew you were of this minority and that's why I'm doing this. I mean, I don't even want to risk crossing that line. And I would imagine those of here that, you know, looking out for tenants, probably also don't necessarily want landlords to be given, you know, carte blanche to ask all of those demographic information, for that information from their tenants. I mean, best case scenario is you're blind to all those protected class areas and make a decision on approving or how you treat your tenants and everything purely on, you know, the stuff you're supposed to. So I would imagine that would probably be echoed throughout. It would be a pretty easy thing to hopefully avoid asking landlords to do, but if possible, working out a way for the city to collect that data, whether it's online or through one of the notice forms that comes from the city or something like that. Do you have another thing, Jessica? Or is yours still just lingering?
Oh.
Okay. Then real quick, I guess, we've got half as many people here as actually on this commission this time, unfortunately. What are our thoughts? Originally on the executive committee, we thought we'd spend just one meeting on this and then get back on schedule next month. What are your guys' thoughts on that, just with the new information of having a very kind of a skeleton crew today and at least half of our committee not actually being able to weigh in?
So to jump in quickly, the regularly scheduled work plan was we were going to talk about introducing security deposits in February, but the meeting got canceled. So the next meeting in sequence would be to introduce security deposits and then to return to some combination of screening criteria and security deposits.
I mean, my thought is if folks that aren't here today have comments on the annual rules, they just provide them to Andres before the next meeting. I kind of don't think we should spend another meeting on it. That's my
Same thing. I don't think anyone's going to flag anything we haven't. If they did, there's still opportunity to make that happen.
And obviously, we do have the option, like when those draft rules come out, you know, if we so choose, of course, we can throw it through the, that discussion onto the agenda at the time too. Then, if that's the case, are we actually getting done 55 minutes early, Andreas?
All right. Unless there's any other comment on what your work plan should be.
Unless anyone feels really strongly about it, I feel like we've talked that one to death. It's just hopefully getting back on track onto the work plan that we did end up on. So, all right, then in that case, I'll call it and we will adjourn.
Andreas, would it be possible to get the working materials regarding
the security deposit? Yes. We'll probably resend it, but I can also send you what we sent that last time. Because I think we'll change some things. We'll see.